Sometimes love sounds like a fight. It sounds like an argument. It sounds just like a pile driver. Welcome to the Sapphicast. I'm your host, Scott C. Episode 23 is in your ears right now. And let me tell you something about the show. We got some stuff lined up already. We're looking ahead on this show. We're always looking to the future. We got some great guests coming up the rest of the spring. We got some great guests coming up in the summertime. We're booking them right now and having a good time with that. Looking forward ahead, some other things. End of March is our one-year anniversary, our birthday, if you will, and we've already got a great show lined up for that one. It's going to be an interesting with a guest that a number of our fans have been asking for and wondering when this one was going to happen. It was bound to happen eventually, and it will at the end of March. I can't say no more. It's like the Beatles' Help, you know? Say no more. I can say no more. Coming up, some other things you should also be aware of. In April, if all goes well, the Sapphicast will be at AWP in Minneapolis making a live appearance there, our coming out party, so to speak, our debutante ball. We'll be there with Sundress Publications and the Sundress Academy for the Arts, and you'll be able to meet me there in person. We'll be doing a couple of live episodes, I say live, you know what I mean, at AWP, including a very special one that, well, we'll have more details on that one in a couple of weeks for you. We're still ironing out a couple of things on that, scheduling it, but it's going to be a very live episode that you, if you are attending the convention at AWP in Minneapolis in early April, I forget, first or second week, I think it's the second week, you can be on the Sapphicast. We'll talk about that though in a couple weeks here on the program. Already looking very far ahead, I'm looking at December even. We had a great response, listener response and feedback for our Christmas episode that we did about depressing holiday music, and people have said, Scott, see, you should do another one of those. So we're already getting some ideas in mind for what we're going to do for December. But that's still 9 months away, so we've got some time to plan that one out. I mentioned listener feedback, and let me tell you something, folks. We at the Sapphicast do listen to our listeners and their feedback, their comments, their questions about the show. You can find us and interact with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Sapphicast. Occasionally we post pictures there, as well as other things, not just promoting the show, but you can find us on there, give us a like, interact with us there. You can find us on Twitter at Sapphicast, SAFTACAST, that is one word. You can find us there as well, and you can find us, of course, on our website at sapphicast.com. Many ways to interact with us. We listen to you. Got an idea for a future guest, a person that you want to suggest? Throw it at us. Got questions for an upcoming guest? Fire off a question to us, or just drop us a line, tell us you enjoy the show. You can also do that on iTunes. Drop on by iTunes there and give us a rating, give us a review. You can give us ratings without the review. You don't have to write anything. You can just give us a rating. Give us a few stars there. We really depend upon that. We depend upon you listening to keep doing this podcast. We really enjoy it. We don't make a dime on the show. We do it out of love. Love for you and love for conversation, which is what we have today. A lovely conversation here. I say I'm doing that because Valentine's Day, you know, corporate love day is this weekend. We've got a great interview for you today. The one and the only podcaster, writer, critic, expert on a number of topics. Chris Sims is on the program today. It was awesome to have him on here, and as you will soon see, it was an awesome discussion, touching on a number of great topics. The depth of pro wrestling, the importance of it, the importance of Batman, the importance of comic books and Japanese television shows. It's just an amazing conversation, and it was truly a great thing to have him on the program. I know you're going to enjoy this one. I even have to say, I think you're going to enjoy it. I know you're going to enjoy it, just as I know you're going to love the theme song.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to the program, man.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for accepting our invite to be on here.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. If we're going to get like the chipmunks now in the old Warner Brothers cartoons, where they start being exceedingly polite to one another. Anyway.
Well, I'm very polite. Ask anyone. They'll tell you that is my defining quality.
Well, I always start off my interviews here with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
Sure, hit me.
You go to hell. There is a jukebox with one song on repeat forever, what song are they using to torture you?
I used to have my, when I was working at the comic book store, I had my alarm set to a local radio station. I didn't put it on like, I mean, look, I live in the middle of South Carolina, so there aren't a lot of great radio stations, but I didn't even put it on like the classic rock one. I put it on the kind of more pop music-y one. And I like pop music a lot, but there was one song, and it was this, I don't even know what the title is, but it was this really awful thing, and all I remember is that there was this, this part of the song, the guy goes, "Oh, how far is heaven?" And it's like the worst, like it worked, because I would get out of bed every time to shut that off. I don't even know the name of the song, I just know that I hate it, and I heard that "how far is heaven" line every morning for like 6 months.
It sounds almost like a Creed song.
It was a little more light, adult contemporary than Creed. I actually have a weird level of affection for Creed because WWE used them for like a video package. So there's like the song "My Sacrifice" will always have a weird place in my heart because of that.
Was that during the Attitude Era?
Oh yeah, it was towards the end of it.
That's the era of wrestling I'm not familiar with. I'm just like starting to learn about it now in my studies, so to speak.
Oh, there was go look up on YouTube WWE "My Sacrifice." You'll get a very emotional video featuring The Undertaker and Kane hugging at one point.
I was gonna say Owen Hart. Oh God, that would be in poor taste with them.
They tend to not put the spotlight on that.
No, they really don't. I was just actually listening to a podcast recently with Roddy Piper up against Vince Russo talking about it.
Oof.
And it was pretty interesting.
That sounds like it would be. That is a dude who's got a lot of things to say that are maybe not necessarily true at any portion of the time, but
I wonder about his side of the events. He says that a rigging company came to them and said, "Hey, we really want to show you what we can do for your company. Let's show you what we can do at the next WrestleMania in a week and a half, or the next big pay-per-view." And I'm like, wait, if a company comes to me and says they want to audition, essentially, you're not going to do it on one of my flagship programs.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually reading a book. I was reading The Death of WCW, and they were talking about how when you'd see, you know, Sting around the same time would do a thing where he was like coming down from the rafters in WCW. And the drama of it was always killed because he would have to take so much time getting out of the harness and getting out of the, you know, the backup harness and everything. Like all the stuff that is there for safety reasons. And so the one that Owen Hart was using as the Blue Blazer had a quick release switch on it. And that was what went wrong.
Yeah, no, you mentioned Death of WCW. Actually, that was Piper's most recent guest on his program, the author of that book.
Yeah, Artie Reynolds?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good book. It's a book that has a very obvious slant to it in that they are very critical of some things that I think they kind of have the wrong idea about in a lot of ways. But I mean, not in a way where I think they're being particularly malicious about it. Just that I think, you know, even a book like that, that is based on the idea of, okay, we're going to go back and examine all of these things and then talk about why they happened. You know, they still have little things that they're mad at. Like there was a bit where they were talking about how, you know, Dusty Rhodes, when he went to WWF, you know, he had the polka dots and the common man thing, and he was the son of a plumber. And they write about how that was, you know, that's all just Vince McMahon trying to humiliate this guy who was a competitor. I've seen interviews with Dusty Rhodes where he's talked about how that was his idea. Like that was a thing that he came up with. And whether that's, you know, just Dusty now obviously being, you know, he's certainly well in the company.
I'm going to defend him on that because I've seen promos and bits he did with Georgia South and such in 81, 82, and he's coming out wearing blue jeans and a t-shirt, and his competitor is coming out, Ric Flair at the time, was coming out in a full suit.
I mean, it feels like it's just the WWF version of what was already going on. You know, it's the slightly more cartoonish version.
The more hyperbolic version.
Yeah, of an already cartoonish guy, you know. And they talk about how they're really dismissive of Diamond Dallas Page. At one point, they talk about a four-way match that he was in, and they talk about how he was the least popular guy in the match. And that's not, I mean, look, I was 15 watching this. I was, you know, 14, 15. And I was in the tank for DDP. Like, DDP was hugely over with the crowd. And, you know, there's just bits and pieces like that. But it is, like, it's a really, really good book. Like, I would, you know, I'm not, it's exhaustively researched and enjoyably written. So I know I sound like I'm kind of criticizing it. Like, but I do, you know, there's little bits and pieces. It's the same thing that happens when I write about comics. You know, I pick and choose things that I want to write about based on what supports my point.
That's what I try and tell my students is, like, when you write a review of anything, it cannot be 100% good or bad. It's a mix. It may be 90-10, but you've got to find the opposite end.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's the thing that I think a lot of people don't really get a lot of the time is that no review is objective. Like, and nothing that has any kind of flavor to it is objective, because otherwise it's just a list of events and when they occurred. Like, you can say Nitro got a historically low rating on this date, and that is an objective fact. But if you, you know, the second you say Nitro got a historically low rating on this date because this match was terrible, then that is, you know, you are no longer objective. You're bringing your opinion into it, and everything you do brings your opinion into it. You know, like, everything, everyone has their thing, you know, like, everyone has a lifetime of historical events that have shaped their perception of the world. And I think these, you know, the Brian Alvarez and Arnie Reynolds have a perception that's shaped by being wrestling fans for such a long time.
And looking for the crap. I mean, their website is like Wrestling Crap or something. Like,
yeah,
that.
Wrestle Crap, which, yeah, I think is an enjoyable website.
So you mentioned objectivity. Has there ever been objective writing in the history of man?
I would venture to say no.
Boy, is that...
I am an opinion writer by trade, so I am obviously going to say no on that one.
Well, David Foster Wallace also mentions is that we see everything from our own vantage point. How can we be objective? It's impossible.
Right, right. Like, it's there's no such thing as a universal experience. If only, I mean, there are things that, you know, there's things that we all kind of went through, but no one has had the exact same list of experiences in their life, and that everything that happens to you and everything you do colors your opinion of everything else. So objectivity is a myth, especially in any kind of writing, and especially in criticism. Like, criticism is, by its very definition, opinion-based, which, who, like, I don't know why anyone would have an idea of there being objective criticism.
It's drilled into students in K-12, you know. Oh, there's objective and subjective writing. No, there isn't.
Well, there are lists of facts, and then there are what those facts mean. You know?
I see what you're saying, yeah.
But yeah, I think people get the idea that there is, that if it's not objective, it's not true. Because it's what we learn about newspaper writing, right? Like, that if it's objective, it's true. And if it's not objective, it's not true. And that's not necessarily the case. You can objectively frame facts. You can frame objective facts in a way that supports a subjective opinion. You can, you know, there is a such thing as biased reporting. And there is also a matter of, you know, I did not wake up this morning expecting to discuss the nature of truth. But just because something isn't, you know, this is a thing I talk about with comics a lot, where just because it's not real doesn't mean it's not true. And the idea that there are things that are truer than true, you know, there's something that's truer than the truth, I think is an interesting concept that we have in fiction.
I'm almost thinking of comics now as modernism in some way that, okay, you've got these fantastic elements, but ultimately there is truth with a capital T. Good is still more attractive than evil. Love is a very powerful force.
Yeah, yeah, I think you get that. I think you've gotten that through the, you know, the history of literature, the history of writing, and the history of mythology. Like, I mean, there's the G.K. Chesterton quote that everyone is so fond of, the, you know, fairy tales don't exist to tell us they're dragons, that dragons can be beaten. You know, like, fictional stories exist to serve a purpose a lot of the time that has a purpose beyond just their own fiction, you know, that just beyond their own flight of fancy.
Exactly. And if that involves Batman beating the shit out of a predator with a Louisville slugger, well, then I'm on board.
Yeah, why not? I believe it was Herodotus who said that is the most noble truth, is the truth of Batman.
I could see that. So you're a bit of an expert on Batman in some ways.
Yep.
Where does that stem from? Like, was there a childhood thing with you that you just, like, suddenly, like, woke up one day and said, like, that's it, that's what I want to do?
I've always loved Batman. And, like, I mean, I can tell you exactly where that comes from. It's a comic that I've written about a bunch. There was one that came out when I was six, Batman 424 and 425. It's a two-part story. In the first part, Jason Todd kills a guy by kicking him off a balcony. And in the second part, the guy's father tries to get revenge on Jason Todd by kidnapping Commissioner Gordon and luring Batman into a trap at a junkyard. And there's a moment where you see Batman going through this junkyard, taking out the guy's hitmen one by one. And it's super violent. Like, it's hilariously violent for a six-year-old to read. But, you know, it's comics in the 80s. And there's a part where Batman runs across one guy and he's looking at him. And he's like, I can tell by looking at this guy that he's not a professional like the others. And he's like, I can have fun with this guy. And so he, you know, he's in a junkyard full of these junk cars. And he pulls a car battery out and just throws it at the dude. And just, like, M.D. Bright draws it, who's a great and very underrated artist. He's also the co-creator of Quantum and Woody with Priest. And just the guy, like, gets just a car battery just chucked into his stomach. And it's one of those things where it's like, oh, yeah, that guy is down. And when I was six, it's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And so I kind of loved Batman from that. And then, you know, when I was seven, the Tim Burton movie came out. When I was 10, the animated series started. So
you were perfect age.
Yeah, like, if you're 10 years old when the Batman the Animated Series starts, you're going to love Batman. At least, you know, it, just how long is it going to stick? And it stuck for life with me.
I can totally relate. I was Return of the Jedi comes out when I'm five.
Yeah, they got you hooked.
I know Empire is a superior film, but damn it, I'm always going to be a soft sucker for Jedi.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it is. I don't think Empire is the best of those three, but I also, I'm a person of extremes in a lot of ways. A friend of mine once told me that I always either love or hate something, and everything I love, I used to hate. And I think he's right, because, you know, I grew up really loving Star Wars, and then, like, up through episode three, I was still holding out. I was like, oh, this is gonna do it. They're gonna tie it together. They have to. Otherwise, I have wasted all this time. And then episode three came out, and that was the, until 2 weeks ago, that was the last piece of Star Wars media I consumed. Like, I was finished. I was done. And it wasn't like a thing where I was like, you know, I didn't write a letter to George Lucas. I didn't make a 7-hour YouTube video complaining about it. I was just like, yeah, I'm done. Because I can, you know, at this point, I can no longer overlook the flaws. And the flaws outweigh what I like about it. And therefore, this is not a thing I can enjoy. Because, like, if you look at, like, the way that I put it was, if you look at what is Star Wars, if you look at everything, there is a very small portion of it that's good. Like, there is, of all the comics, all the novels, all the video games, all the movies and TV shows, and, like, if you look at it, what is good about that is outweighed by the stuff that is bad. And the bad stuff comes directly from the person who created it, so you can't even, like, dismiss it. So I stopped. Like, I just quit.
You know, you've pretty much summed it up for me as well. Now that I think about it, it's like, wow, a lot of, you know, because I was obsessed with the Star Wars video games. And now that I think back, there's only a couple that I was like, that was a fun one. Yeah, I don't even know where to go with that, man. You know,
I had always wanted to be a writer, too. Like, I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 12.
What spurred that on? Like, an English class, or just you started writing on your own at home, or?
I was Dave Barry. My dad was a big fan of Dave Barry and had some collections of his columns. And I read them at 12, which is a week, like, 12-year-olds were not the intended audience for early 90s Dave Barry columns. I enjoyed them. I enjoyed the turn of phrase. And I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. So, like, I wanted to be a columnist from when I was 12, which is, I always talk about Batman and how Batman can't be. I've talked to people who've written Batman. And one of the questions that I always think is really fun is, how old do you think he is when his parents get killed? You know, for some people, like, oh, he's got to be, you know, he's got to be like a 13. And I think that's too old. Like, I feel like he can't be more than 10. Because if you're 13, you know enough to not think being Batman is possible. But if you're 8, then it is a perfectly rational decision for you to go, okay, then I'm going to end all crime. Crime is bad, and I will end it. Which is what Batman decides. He decides, like, he's not going out to fight his parents' murderer, you know, like, that's a nice bonus. But after his parents are killed, like, the matter of Batman's personal vendetta against crime is largely irrelevant, I think, to the character. But he still has to be young enough to think it's possible that he can just stop crime from happening. And that's a very childish idea. And so, like, for me, it's like, yeah, I was just young enough to think, like, oh, I can do this. I can be a writer. Like, this is a thing that's completely possible and supportable in my life. Which, you know, if I had been 14, I probably wouldn't have. If I had been 14, I would have decided on something else. But no, I decided at 12 I wanted to be a writer. And I did it. Just like Batman.
You have. Now, you're not necessarily fighting crime with your art, but, you know.
No. I did not travel around the world to become a science ninja.
No, you did not. Or, you know, have the resources, the financial capital to fund awesome toys like that.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I kind of decided, like, weirdly enough, I never really wanted to write, like, comics or even really movies. Like, I mean, there was a phase, like, when I was in college where I was, like, I read a couple screenwriting books. But I read those more for the... Like, I read those more for their entertainment value. Like, one of the books I read was the Lloyd Kaufman's book that James Gunn co-wrote with him. That's just kind of a history of trauma, which is a very interesting thing, apart from whatever you can learn from it, which is not much. But I think it's called All I Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger was the title, like, the full title of that book. But, like, I wanted to be, like, I wanted to have a syndicated newspaper column. So, like, a weird thing to want at 12.
Not at all. And, you know, in a way you do have that now, working for the websites that you work for and everything. What specifically appealed to you about criticism, though?
Well, you can probably guess, having just talked to me this long.
Just being cranky about things, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm a very cranky person. Where that came from was when I started writing. Like, I started writing it at 17, I would always mention, like, yeah, I started writing professionally at 17, and there were always, like, assholes who were like, professional means you got paid. And I'm like, yeah, I was getting $100 a column at 17, so get bent. I hope I can swear, by the way.
Oh, no, just fucking swear all you want. I don't care. We're labeled on iTunes as explicit for a reason.
And, you know, those were, like, those columns were very, very Dave Barry-ish in that I would see something that I thought was weird on TV or whatever, and I would write about it. And then, like, I lost that job when the dot-com bubble burst, and so instead of getting a check for $400, I got a notice of termination of freelance agreement, which is a very, like, when you're 18, that's a very disheartening thing. So I didn't write for several years. And then when I started up my blog, I was working in a comic book store, and I was just reading comics all day. And I would just literally go to work, sit behind a counter, and when there were no customers in the store, I would just read comics constantly. I would buy comics and then read comics in bed before I went to sleep at night. So I was surrounded by comics and thinking about comics all the time. And so I just started writing about comics, and it became a thing where it's like, okay, this is really good. This is bad. Why does the, you know, this sucks, but this is great. You should read this. So it just kind of just, you know, came from being what I was around.
Eventually somebody just said to you, hey, why don't you start writing some of this stuff down?
Yeah, it's like that is exactly what happened. A friend of mine was like, you should get a blog and write about comics. And I was like, oh, that's self-indulgent bullshit. I don't want to do that. And then I did. And that's what I've been doing for literally 10 years.
Hey, you've had a good deal of success with it, too.
Yeah, it has not sucked. And then, you know, that actually led into writing comics, which is kind of the phase of my career that I'm in now.
Ah, so you are a comics writer.
Yep. Mostly co-write with a guy that I met working at the comic book store, Chad Bowers. And our first graphic novel came out last February, almost a year ago. It was published by Oni Press, which is a relatively major publisher for us. I mean, they, you know, they put out Scott Pilgrim, so they are a going concern. And it was nominated for the YALSA Award, the Young Adult Library Science Award, for best graphic novel for teens of 2014. It was on the book list, top 10 sports graphic novels for teens, which is weird because we didn't really write it thinking of it as a teen book, but I can see why it would be. So yeah, that happened. Chad and I have another story coming out in, we did a backup story in Boom's Bill and Ted comic that's coming up in number 2. And then we have another project that we're working on, but we can't talk about yet.
Totally understand. When Jordan was on the show a year ago, he said he almost spilled the beans and then shut up. But he's like, ah, can't say anything. And it turns out that was the big announcement in at Comic-Con that year was, yeah, we've just handed the reins of Star Wars over to you.
Yeah, that's actually, I said that I hadn't read a, I hadn't partaken in any Star Wars media till 2 weeks ago. And that's because I do, you know, I do a podcast with the editor of the Star Wars comic. So
you're obligated.
I read it as a professional courtesy. I actually told him about it today. I'm like, hey, I read that comic. He's like, oh, thank you. I know that's a big step for you. And he's like, how did you like it? And I was like, it's okay. It's fine.
I bought it the week it came out as well and read it and sent him a photo of me reading one of the old ones, I think issue 77 of the original run, which is, as you were saying, there's a lot of crap. It's one where a monster reaches puberty by hearing Leia, who's dressed up like Cher, doing a bad lounge act.
That sounds good, though. That sounds really good.
And I just looked at it, and I'm like, please, Jordan, if you need someone to help you wreck the canon on this, I have a blowtorch and a hacksaw. I am willing to work for you.
Yeah, like, also, not to continue talking about why I hate Star Wars, but it's like, working in a comic book store, I kind of had a mental categorization of fans of things, like which fans are the worst. And Star Wars fans are not the top, but
they were
like number three. I think the worst were just purely toy guys. Working, and this was, like, before anyone gets super mad, like, this is purely based off the customer base at this one store that I happen to work at. Toy guys were the worst because they would just, like, I once got a call asking who Kitty Pryde was supposed to be because someone had seen a Marvel Legends of Kitty Pryde, and they called me and said, hey, who's Kitty Pryde supposed to be? And I'm like, well, she's supposed to be Kitty Pryde. She's been in the X-Men for 40 years.
But so they were just in it basically for the collectible aspect. Yeah, that's it.
And it, like, we had a bunch that were, like, kind of really obnoxious about it. And like, the Star Wars fans, like, why do they dress up as space Nazis? Like, that's the thing I don't get. Like, why? Why space Nazis? Space Nazis and enslaved Leia.
And this is, like, long before Iron Sky comes to theaters.
Man, I got PR about Iron Sky. I think it was last year at San Diego. And it was like, come see our parade of sexy Nazis. And I was like, fuck you. What? This is your marketing? No, you can get the fuck out of here.
It's like, this was already done with Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS.
Nazi cosplay is always weird. Like, super, super weird. Like, look, just, if you're gonna dress up as the Red Skull, dress up as the Red Skull. Have a blast. Have fun. Just don't put a swastika on it. Like, that's all I ask.
But put the Iron Cross on. That's fine, you know? Put the Iron Cross on. That's cool, you know?
Maybe pushing it a little, but...
Yeah, okay, borderline there, but... Okay, you can wear the suit, but, and just leave off the Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, the stormtroopers, convention stormtroopers will turn you off Star Wars really quick. Nobody ever dresses as Hoth Leia. Nobody ever dresses as kick-ass Carrie Fisher doing massive lines of cocaine between scenes. Like, nobody dresses up as that Leia.
Nobody dresses up as Aunt Faru.
No, it's always, like, I am, like, if I never see another slave Leia, I will live a happy life.
I don't know. There's some creative ones out there, some, you know, takeoffs on it that, okay, I could be down with that, but I think you're right. Once you see a picture of, like, 12 slave Leias all gathered around one person.
Yeah.
It's like, seriously, come up with something more interesting.
And it's, but, you know, look, at the same time, if that is what makes you happy, then by all means, you go enjoy yourself. Look, because I think there's a real short line between being the person who's like, ugh, you know, slave Leias and stormtroopers, and then the cosplayers are ruining conventions, which is objectively not true. Like, that is an objective truth, that the people dressing up, like, the people putting, like, hours and hours into working on these things to express their love of a thing are not the ones ruining conventions.
No.
I just wish they would not dress up like Nazis. That's all. Which I think is reasonable. I think there's a reasonable middle ground there.
If you could cosplay, though, you know, what would you do?
Oh, like, I mean, like, if I...
If you had the capital and such to create a really good outfit, who would you
do? I mean, look, if I could, I would totally... Like, if I was ripped, I would totally be one of those guys that's like, yeah, I'm battle damaged Superman and all my, you know, everything got ripped off. I just had these trunks. I mean, if I could, I'd be Namor. Like, but no, like, I don't know, like, like I love cosplay. I think it's one of the coolest things. We do a feature on it every week. Betty Fellin does the best cosplay, and it's like so amazing. And it's like it's so much work, and it's so creative. And I love it's the only thing I look forward to about going to San Diego. That and In-N-Out Burger, because I hate Comic-Con. I hate the San Diego Comic-Con. It's the worst thing in the world. But I love, the one thing that's really cool about it is that everyone has, there's so much cosplay, and it's all so cool. But I don't know what I would do. I mean, there are costumes in comics that I think are really good, but, I would want something that is, as close to normal clothes as possible.
Go as one of the Batman villains from the 60s TV series.
Oh, man, I would love, if I could get, a bookworm suit, that weird leather suit that Roddy McDowall had. Oh, that would be great. That would be so hot.
Or do one of the henchmen. Just, have a turtleneck. And, a little beret on, and a robber's mask. Pretty much all you need.
The goons.
Yeah.
The goons, yeah. Or the Catwoman henchman who had the tiger stripe shirts and the little cat ear leather hats. Those are cool.
Get a whole bunch of you to together to do that as a group, and then just descend on a Batman.
I would, I would probably end up being, Jack Knight. Because it's just, it's a leather jacket and clothes and goggles. And you have to carry around a stick. That's it. It's very, I want to dress for comfort.
I think what I would do, I think the one I've always wanted to do, there's two of them. One is Steve Hansen from Slapshot, with the fake blood all over my face or anything.
Oh, that would be, that's a good one.
And just scream at people, I'm trying to listen to the fucking song.
Yeah.
Or Dr. Clayton Forrester from MST3K.
See, that's all you, that's, just a coat and pants and some white streak in your hair. That's good.
And just do a little moosing, spike the hair up, and get a little white streak through there in the mustache, and I'm cool.
I mean, look, I mean, I am pretty close to TV's Frank just in my real life. So, but my hair tends to pompadour up every now and then.
He would be easy, too. Just black pants, black long sleeve shirt. I can't remember if it's buttoned down or not, if he has a buttoned vest-type shirt, and then just make the curl in your hair. That's the big thing.
I think that's a good idea. Since we do the Sailor Moon podcast, we've been talking a lot about cosplay options, and there's an episode where Sailor Moon gets turned into a tennis ball, so she's, just a head and legs and hands sticking out of a tennis ball, and, I don't think I could pull that off, but I would love to see. That is a cosplay I have not seen that I would love to see, is Tennis Ball Sailor Moon.
I would be absolutely fascinated, yes. I am one of the fans of your podcast. I've been listening since the beginning, and I am one of those people, Jordan mentions me in 9 backhandedly by saying, actually, there are people who are listening who are not watching the show.
I've had a couple. Chad is actually listens to it but doesn't watch the show, which I'm like, how, do you enjoy it?
Actually, I do. Without knowing it, and it's funny because I have broken my rule about it, because on Jordan's suggestion, I had to watch the act sorry scene just to see a guy telling a monkey to act sorry. I lost it. And
it's real good.
On New Year's, I did watch a couple episodes of Crystal with my wife, who's a big Sailor Moon fan, and I found the greatest thing was that I didn't have to keep asking, who's that person? Who's that person? What's going on?
Oh, who's this creep who just showed up and insulted the main character? That must be Darien. That must be Mamoru.
Exactly. I'm sitting there going, he really is a jackass.
Really is. He is a complete jerk. So
no, it's an enjoyable podcast. I think we've mentioned it a couple times on the program here. We had a Sailor Moon devotee on a couple months ago who didn't know of the podcast. And I said, you should check it out then. It's fascinating.
I'm glad people are out there enjoying it. It's a fun one to do. It's a really fun one to do. So
I can't name really any. There are a few podcasts out there that are similar in that style that do, let's watch a movie and dissect it, or let's watch a TV show and dissect it, but not what I think you guys are doing, which is watching the whole series in sequence.
The one that I think has the closest format to what we're doing was Go Bayside, which is a very, very funny podcast that April Richardson, comedian, did, where she and a guest would watch every episode of Saved by the Bell. And it was very, we've kind of added bits and pieces and segments. We do listener questions. We talk about our guests having a history with Sailor Moon. We do the morals at the end, but the idea of getting a guest to come in every week and sit down and watch an episode of a thing for the entire series. Go Bayside was the first one I heard that was doing that. And I'm sure there's another. There's one that I listen to called Super Sentai Bros, Live and Let Die Ranger, where there's two brothers who are watching every episode of Gosei Sentai Die Ranger, which is the 1993 Super Sentai show. It's the one where the White Ranger costume, Tommy's White Ranger costume on Power Rangers comes from, but that was never brought over to America. It's the one before it was the basis for Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and they did the one after it, which I think was Power Rangers Turbo, but they didn't do Die Ranger for some reason. They brought over one character and the robots, and did not actually do the show. So that one is going, and it's enjoyable. But yeah, I think Go Bayside is one people should check out, because it's very, very funny. And you know, if you are probably between 25 and 35, you had the experience of seeing Saved by the Bell on 18 times a day when you were growing up.
Oh,
so.
Yes. I had to deal with it. I was never a big fan of the show. Could never get into it. Because I always looked at high school shows at the time. Like, why isn't my high school like that?
That's a funny thing, because she talks about how the first time she watched it, like, she watched it all through high school, but, like, she was watching it in middle school, assuming that that is what high school was going to be like, and it obviously is not. It's a very, very, very funny show.
Is Sailor Business the first podcast you've ever regularly done?
Oh, no. I have done a podcast for over 5 years, 6 years. It's called War Rocket Ajax, which is at warrocketajax.com. Matt Wilson and I do that show, and it's a comics and pop culture review show. We talk about movies we've seen, video games we've played, we review comics in every episode, and then we do an interview with a comics creator, usually a comics creator. We've had some non-comics people that we've interviewed, just people who are interesting. We had Caitlin Kittredge was one of our first guests. She would go on to write comics later, but at the time she had only written novels and was working in video games, I think. We've had Evan Funk Davies, who was a DJ on WFMU. We had him on. But most of our guests seem to be pretty comics focused. Oh, we've had a couple pro wrestlers too, but we often talk about the comics that pro wrestlers read.
There's a lot of crossover in that world.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is.
Roddy Piper has a comic coming out now. I think it's Roddy Piper Monster Killer.
That sounds good. I mean, pro wrestling and comics are very, very similar American art forms, but they're not really similar in the way that people latch onto. Like, in the obvious way. Like, oh yeah, it's dudes in tights beating each other up. And that's true, but that's not the similarity. The similarity is they're both long-form, serialized narratives that are never supposed to end. Theoretically, the story, in quotes, the story of WWE will go on forever. Like, until they run out of money.
And it's built all upon archetypes.
Yeah. The difference, and what makes pro wrestling really interesting to me, and what makes pro wrestling, like, pro wrestling, I've said often, is the one thing that I love that I would never want to be involved in making. Not because I don't think it's interesting, and not because I don't think it's viable, but just because it's way more fascinating from the outside. Because Batman isn't gonna quit DC Comics. Like, Batman isn't going to get tired of working for DC Comics and leave. And, you know, DC's going to have to make the Joker someone else's archenemy. That will never happen. Eventually, you know, John Cena is going to retire. Like, CM Punk is going to leave WWE. And then they're going to have to reshuffle everything and figure out what they want to do with their stories. Like, the collision of reality and fiction in pro wrestling is fascinating to me. Because it works best when it's purely fiction. But it never can be, because there are real people. Like, the line between, not to use real names, but the line between, you know, Phil Brooks, the guy, and CM Punk, the character, is blurry and occasionally non-existent. And if the guy decides he doesn't want to be the character anymore, then you don't get to use that character anymore. Or you have, like, Sin Cara. Where Sin Cara was a character they created for a guy, for Mystico, and then Mystico wasn't working out, so Mystico went back to Mexico, and another guy became Sin Cara, and the character continued with no acknowledgement that it was a different guy who's 40 pounds heavier and has a tattoo.
Happened quite often in the WWF days.
Yeah, they like to play it off now, but, like, they thought fake Diesel and fake Razor Ramon were going to work. The difference is those guys did not wear masks. You know.
And there are the moments, too, where that line is so obvious and the struggle to keep the kayfabe going is wonderful. Like, I think of The Machines and Bobby Heenan flipping out saying, that is Andre the Giant under that mask. And everybody's like, no, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. Even though it is painfully obvious to the audience and everybody else, it is Andre. And they made it so that it's only Bobby Heenan who realizes the truth going on.
Yeah. And then you get stuff like, I mean, we just talked about the death of WCW, and it's what happens if you write a Batman story? and Batman decides he doesn't like the story. So Batman uses his creative control option. He's like, I don't look, you know, if you have the Joker beat me in the cliffhanger, I don't look as good. And so you have to rewrite the story so that there's never any real danger to Batman. Because that's what happened with Hulk Hogan. Like, Hulk Hogan had creative control. I don't like it when people say like, oh yeah, you know, the characters really took over that story. Because I feel like that is not a thing that happens. Like, that's a thing people say, and it can be easy to write. But if you're not in charge of your story, then, you know, then what are you doing? But like, in wrestling, you literally have a writer writing characters who can decide not to do it, which is amazing. Like, that is fascinating to me, and it sounds like a fucking nightmare. Like, I read somewhere that like new writers for like WWE have like an average, you know, lifespan with the company of like 6 months, and I can see why, because if you're a writer, your characters shouldn't talk back.
It's like, I've got this great idea planned out for you for 3 months and everything. And then, you know, not even creative control option. What if the wrestler gets hurt?
Yeah. Yeah. What if, you know, what if Batman couldn't be in Batman comics for 6 months? Yeah. Or what if Batman got a better offer from Marvel and you didn't sign Batman to a contract? So Batman, you know, Batman's teaming up with Spider-Man now, guys. Sorry. Batman's in Japan. Batman went to Japan and he's in Shonen Jump now because they're paying him. Or what if, you know, what if the Joker didn't like the reaction he was getting and wanted to be a good guy after years and years of murdering people? Wrestling relies on not just on good guys and bad guys, but it relies on turns, you know, face turns and heel turns, like doing the unexpected. Like, there's very few wrestlers who have ever been good guys all their career or bad guys all their career. Ricky Steamboat.
I was just about to say, he's the first one that comes to mind.
Like, even John Cena was a bad guy to start, you know, became the kind of overwhelming good guy. It's so fascinating to me, like, how you can put it together. Because when it works, it's compelling on every level. Like, when it works, I mean, look, I love pro wrestling. And when it works, it's physically compelling because you have the people in the ring who are telling a story physically on that level. But it also works with the story around it. Like, the Sami Zayn Adrian Neville story in NXT last year is one of the best pro wrestling stories of all time because it's a long build and it relies on defined character. And also both those guys are really good. Like, Sami Zayn is one of the best, you know, wrestlers in the world right now. Giving him a very character-based story and kind of playing up the idea, oh, he can't win the big one unless he's underhanded about it. And for his part, I think, you know, Adrian Neville's contribution to that story, really underrated. But, you know, it's really interesting to me that there are real people. And you know, real people who are often very justified in their concerns. You know, no, I don't want to go out there and do that because that's going to damage my... You know, that's going to damage my character. Like, that is a legitimate concern.
And human concerns, too. There's the famous story of Ricky Steamboat against Jake Roberts, and Vince called for, I want you to DDT him on the concrete outside the ring. And Jake went, no, you realize what this move does? And Steamboat was like, no, I can handle it. I can handle it. And sure enough, okay, Jake goes along with it. He's like, okay. And sure enough, he gave Ricky a concussion.
Yeah.
I agree with you on a lot of levels. I'm fascinated with what happens to them afterwards and what's going on in their lives at that moment. I became obsessed in the last 12 months with the 80s era of pro wrestling and just studying it on so many different levels of what's going on with these people at the time. And it's absolutely fascinating to find out things like, George Steele is currently a assistant pastor on the west coast of Florida. And yet, then you watch him in the ring and you're like, the guy has no brain cells.
Yeah. I mean he was in, you know, he was in Ed Wood.
Yeah. He played Tor.
He's really good in Ed Wood. It's a fascinating storytelling thing because you have so many concerns that are in complete opposition to each other. And yet somehow, like, every now and then, everything works.
And you get a match that is just magical to watch.
It's a lot harder to write a pro wrestling story than I think anything else because you're juggling so many moving parts. Like, I have, you know, nothing but the utmost respect for people who manage to pull it off. And nothing but utmost contempt for the people who seem to be doing it so much lately.
No, sometimes it does not work. I'm sure we could say, you know, we can just go to that website, you know, and look at all the crap that has come out over the years.
Yeah.
Is there a particular moment in wrestling that just sticks with you, like, this is emblematic of everything?
I mean, that Sami Zayn, Adrian Neville match, like, was pretty perfect in a lot of ways. Other than that, like, I mean, you know, Bash at the Beach 96, like, the Hogan's turn. Like, it really was, like, a shocker. Like, it is amazing that it happened. Because it's, you know, it's... You wouldn't think they would ever do, but in retrospect, it's so obvious.
I think for me, it's... There's a moment on Tuesday Night Titans in the 80s where you have Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji, and they try doing a vaudeville routine. And there is so much in this 3 minutes. The timing is terrible from them. It's obvious they're bad. But there's small things, like, for some reason, a stagehand sticks a 2x4 out to knock off Fuji's hat with no explanation. There's Gene Okerlund giving the finger to them, and then an iron hook pulling Mr. Fuji off, and him just looking really confused and going, "What is this?" And totally unsure of himself at that moment. And I just think to myself, why was this done? This is everything, though, for me.
Sounds good. I need to go back. Like, I really want to... I grew up watching, you know, NWA and WCW in the South, and I've obviously gone back and watched a lot of WWF. I really want to go back and watch... Like, Tuesday Night Titans seems like such a weird, weird thing, because it's so... It could not have come from anybody but Vince McMahon. Like, oh yeah, people are going to want to watch a hour-long talk show with the wrestlers, of course.
Exactly.
That's what they want to see.
Do a David Letterman show, but the guests are always pro wrestlers, and they always are in character.
Yeah. I mean, there's one level where that's brilliant, and then there's another level where how do you arrive at that conclusion? Like, how do you arrive at the conclusion that Raw should be 3 hours long and have 6 minutes of wrestling in the first hour? Like,
the WWE has made a lot of questionable moves in my lifetime.
Ugh. Have they ever? But that's the thing, like, you know, you... Look, there's been a lot of bad comics in my life. I've read a lot of terrible comics. I've read a lot of terrible Batman stories. But when they are good, there is nothing better. When there is a good Batman story, there is nothing in the world that I like better than that first time I read Batman Year One, or that first time I read Dark Knight Returns, that first time I read Batman R.I.P. Like, there's nothing better than that. And this kind of goes back to Star Wars, because we've had, like, what, you know, 2,000, 2,500 Batman comics over 75 years? How many of them are good? Like there, and there's probably more than that. That's just, like, core Batman stories. Like, thousands and thousands of Batman comics. And I've read hundreds and hundreds of them. How many are good? How many are actually worth it? I mean, there's a lot, to be honest, for me. You know, how many hours of wrestling have I watched where I've just been waiting for the good thing to happen? And how much does it balance out? You know, how much do you put up with to get to the thing you love? You know, how many movies do you see before you get a Die Hard? Before you get, you know, the one that makes it all worth it?
That's a good point. When people ask me, you know, what are my favorite movies, I can only list about five. And I've seen, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600 movies in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's like a David Lee Roth, Hero to Millions, when he did his solo EP. And everybody was like, why are you just doing an EP? Like, why aren't you doing an album? And he goes, well, you know, you listen to an album, there's only four good songs on it anyway. And I'm like, that's an amazing philosophy for you to have, David Lee Roth. Like, I'm only doing the good songs. And three of them are going to be covers, by the way. It's brilliant. The man is brilliant.
Yeah, but I still would not want to have been saved by him when he was an EMS paramedic.
Oh, yeah, you would think you died, right? Like, there's no way you would... Like, how many people died because they woke up and saw David Lee Roth and thought they were dead and their bodies just gave up?
Also, I think it would just be he would never let you down on it. Like, he would be visiting you or calling you every 2 weeks and be like, Diamond Dave saved your life.
I would get that tattooed. I would get, like, a chest piece. It was like, Diamond Dave saved my life.
Diamond Dave gave me CPR. Well, maybe he was practicing on all those groupies then with the Eddie Van Halen days.
I'm pretty sure that's what they were doing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. They were rehearsing for a play, you know.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so talked about pro wrestling and such. So where does your obsession with these Japanese shows come from? I want to come back to that for a moment. You know, not only Sailor Moon, but the Sentai shows. Like, where does that obsession come from with you?
I've always had like kind of a nostalgic fondness for Power Rangers. Because, you know, again, I was 10 years old in 1992. I was 11 in 93. So I was the target demographic. I was an 11-year-old in a karate class. So I like Power Rangers a lot. And then I have this weird streak of being a completist in me. One of the things that I blogged about, and one of the reasons that I like the character so much now, is that I was playing a Punisher video game, and I liked the Punisher, but I had only really read the Garth Ennis run, you know? Like, I'd only really read the popular run of the Punisher. And I was like, well, I work in a comic book store. We have 300 long boxes of back issues, because this is a huge store. I was thinking, like, I bet I could put together a full run of Punisher comics, like, every Punisher solo story, I bet I could do it. And so, like, I decided, oh, hey, I'm going to read every Punisher comic. And so I went to work, and I spent about a day with a long box putting together, at the time, 300 issues of Punisher. All of Punisher volumes 1 through 7, plus Warzone and War Journal. And I read them. And the weird thing is that when you do that, you have spent so much time with a character that even if you didn't particularly care before, you care now. Like, you've put in the hours. With Power Rangers, like, they're all on Netflix. There's 20 years of Power Rangers on Netflix. And I kind of like, oh, that's, you know, I remember that. That's good. And, you know, I like superheroes a lot. Like, you know, I write superhero comics. I read superhero comics. It's, you know, if superhero is truly a genre, which it is, like, it is a genre of which I am a fan. Which is weird because I always talk about how little I care about most adaptations, like movies and TV stuff. Like, I can take or leave. But, like, I do like superhero stories. So I just watched 20 years worth of Power Rangers on Netflix. And it's also a thing where, like, I like to have stuff on in the background. So it would be on in the background while I work or on in the background while I play video games or whatever. Like, you know, if you're playing Pokemon, there's a lot of walking around and leveling up. There's a lot of grinding in the game. So why not have something on in the background? As far as getting into the Japanese versions, Caleb Goldner, who was the editor at Comics Alliance, was really into Power Rangers and also Super Sentai, because they are weirdly different in a lot of ways. Most notably in that there is way more Super Sentai, because their seasons are 50 episodes long. They just run every week for a year, and they change at the end of the year. Like, they change in February. New one's going to start up soon. And so, like, he we would talk about it. And it's a really interesting genre, because they're clearly superhero stories, but they are superhero stories that descend from a different tradition and have their different conventions and are made for a different audience. American superhero comics are always kind of chasing the dragon of serious literature, you know, like Watchmen. Watchmen's the best comic of all time because Watchmen is the comic that's, you know, that's literature. So, like, comics want that respectability, but, like, Japanese superheroes, more often than not, feels like they could give a shit about respectability. It's like, no, it's for kids. And I think they do that because manga in Japan never had the Comics Code, never had Wortham, never had everything but superheroes getting shut down. So there are the superhero tradition that kind of descends from Osamu Tezuka and Shotaro Ishinomori is not one that existed in a world where the government ruled that comics were for children. You know?
And said you can't have graphic things in there, you gotta clean it up, Tales from the Crypt goes bye-bye.
Yeah, so there was never that weird inferiority complex that American comics grew up with, because American comics have an inferiority complex. Like, American comics, they want to be serious so bad that they can't help but sound like a teenager. They're like, no, I'm a grown-up. Come on.
Take me seriously.
Yeah, exactly. Japanese comics and Japanese superheroes never had that. So, like, Kamen Rider and Super Sentai have kind of accepted that they're for kids. Like, and they've been for kids. Like, Tokuger, Resha Sentai Tokuger, which is the latest, the one that's about to end now, could not be for tinier babies. It is such a show for tiny babies. They are on a magic train called the Rainbow Line, and they fight evil with the power of imagination. But it's also, like, really good. Like, I think a lot of what attracts me to superheroics in general is the idea of, like, uncompromising heroism. There is nothing I hate more than a Superman who kills people. And that is, you know, that is the Superman that DC decided that millions of moviegoers should see. A Superman who can't figure out a solution other than to kill someone. A guy who can shoot heat vision out of his eyes and fly. But when the villain says, oh, you're going to have to kill me to stop me, Superman goes, yes, that is correct. The villain, you, villain, are correct. I must kill to stop you.
Not only that, think of all the people and all the buildings that were destroyed during that whole third act.
Oh, I think that's just a function of nobody thought to put in a scene where it's like, we're all evacuated.
Because that's where I drew the line at that film. It's like, okay, the opening bit's interesting film. I'm like, okay, curious to see where this goes. I like the idea of it. And then we get to the third act, I'm like, that's it, I'm out.
I have never not been mad at Man of Steel since I saw it. Like, I'm still angry about it, which is unhealthy. So if you want to have that conversation, we'll be here for a while.
I still carry episode one in me. And I still feel like Simon Pegg on Spaced. You weren't there at the beginning. You don't know what it was like.
But it's, you know, because they don't have that pressure to be grown up, Sentai shows and Kamen Rider have this weird thing where they don't mind being this kind of uncompromisingly heroic show, even when they're skewing, you know, Sentai is for tiny babies and Kamen Rider is for slightly older babies. they're all shows for children. And they aren't shy about kind of pure heroism, which I really find attractive in superheroes, especially when it's, I mean, and also it's really well done. Kamen Rider Forze, which is the one that really got me hooked, is at its heart, it is a story about a dude, you know, it's about kids turning into monsters because they have teen problems, which is also the basis of one of the comics that I write. And I make no bones about it. Like, Skater X, which is the comic that the kind of tokusatsu comic that I write, is a tribute, if you want to be nice, complete ripoff, if you want to not be nice, of Kamen Rider Forze, because it speaks to me. So, you know, teens turn into monsters because they're teen problems, and then the hero shows up and beats up the monster and turns them back into the kids, and then makes friends with them and says, hey, we're gonna solve your problems. It's gonna be okay. And there's a level of heroism to that that is largely absent, like, even in many of the kind of best modern Western superhero comics, just because, you know, there's so many comics are about, oh, these, you know, these cut and dry solutions won't work in our modern world of complexities and shades of gray. I do like the idea of, like, no, heroism does work.
Sometimes it really does boil down to good versus evil, and good wins.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's the Sami Zayn, Adrian Neville story. Like, I can't get behind John Cena. And it's not because John Cena is, you know, a good guy. It's because John Cena is a good guy who comes out and calls a woman a whore. There are people who watch wrestling who will tell you, oh, that's okay because she's evil. She's bad. It's like, no, that's never okay. Like, that's not okay at all. And you can't have your good guy coming out and saying that. I can get behind Sami Zayn, the good guy who has the opportunity to not even cheat, but take a shortcut. But he won't do it because that's not how he wants to win, because that's not what he's built his career on.
That is
a story of heroism that I can love.
That's not honorable.
Yeah, like those are ideas that I think are important in fiction, because if you lose those ideas in fiction, you lose them in life. And I believe in the power of fiction as a teaching tool and a reflective tool. And again, I am also a dude who has, my favorite video games are Saints Row games, like, which are about these ridiculous, amoral, murdering street gang sociopaths. But nobody is saying, like, oh, these are superheroes. These are role models. Whereas, you know, John Cena is a role model. Superman is a role model. Batman is a role model. Spider-Man is a role model. Kamen Rider is a role model. The Super Sentai characters, those are role models. Those are for kids. Those are heroes for kids. There's also a whole thing where I have called, like, you know, Superman is a cartoon character for children. I believe that. Like, I'm not saying he's not complex, and I'm not saying you cannot enjoy him as an adult, obviously, but Superman is a cartoon character for children, and I think if you pull him away from that, it doesn't work. But yeah, again, that is, look, it's been 2 years. I never don't wake up in rage over Man of Steel.
It would have been so much better if they tacked on like a 20-minute epilogue where Superman is really wrestling with the psychology of, why didn't I try to stop him from dying? What... And then, like, the aftermath in his mind would have been interesting, I think.
The thing that gets me, and it gets me, like, and it's, look, not to just pick on Man of Steel, because I honestly felt this way about Avengers, too. Like, I think
I think Avengers is a good movie, but I think the best thing about Avengers is that they did it, and it worked as well as it did, because they really are juggling multiple genres in a way that you really only get from, you know, a shared universe superhero comic. But when that movie came out, I was like, yeah, I liked this movie, but doesn't anybody else think it's weird that that movie ends with Iron Man throwing a nuclear bomb at the Skrulls? That movie ends with Iron Man nuking the Chitauri? Like, does nobody else think that's weird? And I have people tell me, and I have people tell me this about Man of Steel too, and it's like, oh, well, he didn't have a choice. And that is when I know that I need to leave that conversation, because, well, okay, Superman didn't have a choice, but David Goyer wrote the script, and he had all the choices in the world. You know, Avengers wasn't a fucking documentary. Like, nobody decided to bomb New York City, and Iron Man had to deal with this unavoidable problem. Like, and people like to argue with me and add in, like, real-world concerns. It's like, oh, so you know, if somebody's trying to, you know, you wouldn't, you know, kill the aliens to save all those lives. And it's like, guys, it didn't happen. Like, it could have been a giant banana. It didn't have to be a nuclear bomb. Like, someone made up everything that happened here. Someone made it up. And that's why it's so frustrating. Like, there was an interview with David Goyer where he was like, oh, well, our Superman can't just jump, to, you know, fly to the moon. It's like, well, why not? Did you go talk to the real Superman and find out his limitations? Like, the, you know, limitations only exist to make the story more fun, and the limitations exist to be surpassed. I mean, look, Superman Returns doesn't make any fucking sense, and it's bad. And one of the reasons it's bad is that Superman picks up a giant island made of kryptonite and throws it into space. You know, it picks up an item, a thing made of the stuff that people say multiple times, like, oh, this makes him weak. This takes away his superpowers. And he just picks it up and throws it into space so that he can strike a Jesus pose. You know, I'll take that, you know, Superman overcoming his limits than Superman agreeing with the villain. Like, the thing that I think says it all about Man of Steel is that the villain says, you'll have to kill me to stop me, and Superman doesn't find a way. That Superman proves the villain is correct. The person who is correct in the Superman movie is the villain. Which, no, like, the villains can never be right. Like, the villains can have logic to the way they think. Like, that's, you know, Dr. Doom has a logic to the way he thinks, but Reed Richards didn't sabotage his machine, you know?
It's like, Superman 2, we go back to the other portrayal of Zod, there's logic, but then we get to see Superman was clever. He tricked him. Aha!
He throws him off a cliff.
He eventually good triumphs over evil, and he does it in a clever way. And we're like, ah, if only I could be that smart. It's wish fulfillment. It's fantasy.
Yeah. It's like the molecule chamber is the best part of Superman 2. And I've said, like, multiple times that the only good Superman movie is Superman 3, and it's the one that everybody hates because it's so silly. And it's like, yeah, but you know, he flies, right? Like, you know, he flies and can pick up a car with one hand. Like,
if you can do that, I can't believe Richard Pryor is a computer programmer.
The idea of realism in superhero comics really bugs me, because they don't need to be realistic. They need to be consistent, because a story needs to be logically consistent. So as long as a story is logically consistent, you don't need realism. Like, the idea that, you know, the idea that people like Batman because he's human. I don't understand that. People who say, I don't like Superman because he's overpowered, you know, you can't beat him. If that's the way you think, fine. But then don't also say you like Batman. Because when was the last time you saw Batman lose? He's a protagonist.
Can he lose to anyone, do you think?
No, because then we don't get any more Batman comics.
Mm. He could get beaten for a time, like Bane breaking his back or something, but...
Yeah, but, you know, he comes back. It's a cliffhanger. It's like, watch an episode of 66. He loses in the first part, he wins in the second part. That's how it works. There's this weird fundamental misunderstanding of what a protagonist does and what an antagonist does. Like, and then you have people... There is a reason Batman doesn't kill the Joker. There are multiple reasons. There is a canonical reason, and there is a metatextual reason. The metatextual reason is that Batman can't kill the Joker, because then we don't get any more Joker stories.
It's like the Frank Miller one. You need me, basically.
But, like, that's from a real-world financial standpoint. Comics with the Joker sell. People like reading about the Joker. If people stop liking to read about the Joker, then we won't need any more Joker stories, and then we can kill the Joker. But he'll come back. you know, because people like to read death and resurrection stories. But whether or not it exists in service to the character, or whether or not it is a construct to support that idea, there is a canonical reason why Batman doesn't kill the Joker. It's just whether you accept it or not. And the canonical reason is that Batman doesn't kill. Like, that's literally all you need. Oh, because Batman doesn't kill people. Like, that's the end of the sentence. Now, you can talk about the whys of that if you want to, but at the end of the day, that is the rule. And that's the rule. Like, you either accept that, you either get on board with that premise or you don't. And if you don't get on board with that premise, then I don't know what you're doing here. It's like, there's other comics.
Go read The Punisher. You know.
Yeah, you should. If you want to know why Batman can't kill the Joker, read 300 issues of Punisher and note that there are three recurring villains in 300 issues.
What, Jigsaw and, like, maybe two others? Yeah.
There's Jigsaw, and there's Kingpin, and there's the literal devil.
Oh, and the Marquis de Sade character, I think, comes back in a second issue. Because I remember reading, like, an annual or something. I used to have it, and they make reference to, like, their first meeting or something. Now, whether that actually did happen in a comic or not, or it's just Frank and them talking out of their heads, I don't know. Very few recurring characters.
Yeah, because, you know, because when you kill them, you can't use them anymore. That's why you can only name three Punisher villains. Like, that's why you can't name them, because they're not interesting characters, because they don't exist to be interesting.
Generic mob boss number 17.
Yeah, so, you know, Joker's interesting, Dr. Doom's interesting. The Punisher characters only need to be interesting for 15 pages, and then they get shot in the face. That's why the, you know, the trick of the Garth Ennis run is that they're six-issue stories, and the first three issues, inevitably, of Punisher Max, the first three issues make you hate these people, and the last three issues make you glad to see them get killed. The first three issues are your reason why these people have to die, and the last three issues are
them dying.
Here's these people dying. Like, that is the circle of that story.
Oh, the circle of life in comics.
Yeah.
So how are you taking the whole Deadpool dying thing? I gotta ask.
Well, I mean, we all know that death in comics is the end of a character.
That's why I couldn't understand. As soon as it was announced, the amount of hatred that was out there, and I'm like, have you read comics? I can't. Even Pucci came back on The Simpsons. And then Marvel, of course, made the big announcement, hey, we're basically blowing everything up and starting again. And that was like, well, there you go. That's why they were holding off. They're doing something with that.
And there are people mad about that, too. And it's like, there are times when I just want to ask people, like, have you read a comic book before? Because, like, even when DC threw out their universe and rebuilt it from the ground up, like, you know, there's still continuing threads. There's still themes that carry over. Like, even though, you know, they might not be the ones I like. Like, you know, guys, don't worry.
give it 10, 15, 20 years when your kids are about 10 years or so, they'll reboot them again. They did it with us.
Also, you know how many Marvel comics there are? Like, if you there's plenty to read. But again, I say this as I say this as someone who, again, I've been mad about Man of Steel for 3 years.
And you continue right on being mad at it, because I will be with you. Maybe not as vehement, but I've got my issues with that film. We are almost out of time, Chris. It has been great talking with you.
Well, thank you.
It has been, you know, great conversation. I love talking to people and nerding out over things. So before we go, though, the folks can find you online in multiple places. Where can they find you?
The easiest place to go is just to go to about.me/ChrisSims, ChrisSims. That has links to my Twitter, my Tumblr, my website, the comics that I've written that are on Comixology. You can also find me on Twitter at TheIsB, TheIsB, as in Batman. I am the senior writer of ComicsAlliance.com. So if you want to read reviews of comics or humor pieces about how much I hate Funky Winkerbean, please feel free to head over there.
Chris, you're not alone on that one.
It's real bad. I'm so mad about Funky Winkerbean. Like, I have never been as mad as I am this month at Funky Winkerbean.
Familiar. I keep up with a daily newspaper comics thread, and that and Luann and Nancy, Guy Gilchrist. Should burn in a fire, in my opinion.
Yeah, that new Nancy is not good.
No, Guy Gilchrist, basically, I've got issues with him and his view of Americana. But I will never stop loving Newspaper Spider-Man. It's just so ridiculous.
Oh, Newspaper Spider-Man's so good.
Any place where Spider-Man can get knocked out by a brick, I love.
Good old Roy Thomas seems to forget that spider sense is a thing about 75% of the time.
And that's what makes it wonderful. And you're also, of course, your podcasts. Your other one?
Sailor Business, War Rocket Ajax, and Movie Fighters. They're all available on iTunes. We have a Patreon for War Rocket Ajax, which also kind of includes Movie Fighters, but we funded this year Movie Fighters on Kickstarter, so it's basically for War Rocket Ajax. If you enjoy that show, go to patreon.com/War Rocket Ajax and kick a couple bucks our way if you feel like it. But if not, just enjoy the show.
Cool. You're also occasional writer at crack.com.
Yeah, I actually just had an article go up this week.
Yeah. One about how to spot Satanists, the training
video. There's. I wrote about the tips you can learn from a 1994 police training video on dealing with satanic crimes.
I loved the fact that the Satanists were so helpful in just, you know, spray painting a tree with a pentacle so that you'd know.
It's wet to the touch. So weird.
It's just, you know, they're so helpful, those Satanists, sometimes.
It's almost like they got there right before the camera crew did.
Chris, it has been wonderful talking to you, man. You enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.